Good evening. This is the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, June 22nd. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm really glad you could join us this evening. Tonight, we're going to review the top stories and events in money and markets. We've gotten some incredible questions for Ask Catherine. We're going to go through several of them. But if you don't get your question answered tonight, we're going to keep working on them in the next Solari Reports. Then we're going to go to Let's Go to the Movies and take a look at what I think is arguably the most useful series of movies for really understanding how our world works and how we can protect our relationships, our families, and our assets, and that's the Godfather series. So money and markets, as I've talked about before on the Solari Report, I've been very concerned about the inauguration date as a milestone in what I call the shakeout that's been happening in the financial system and in the United States economy. When I became Assistant Secretary of Housing in 1989, prior to that time, a great deal of effort had gone in to hold together the financial system and the economy during the election in 1988, and a lot was held together until the election, and things started to unwind and seep out, and then the inauguration happened, and then all hell broke loose. So I've kind of been waiting for this inauguration with bated breath. A lot has been held together, and so we're going to see what happens. There's an interesting twist. I've been waiting to see if the Treasury Secretary nomination would go through. We're going to get a Treasury Secretary who in many respects is very different than the ones we've had before. This gentleman does not have significant line management experience and big money responsibility in the tradition of other secretaries. The Treasury's never run a big private firm as Rubin did, as Paulson did, as Nick Brady did. And so he's much more from a policy background, as is Summers as well, National Economic Advisor, although he has been Treasury Secretary, and Gaither has been the New York Fed Chairman. But we're looking at somebody who's a lot less financially secure and with a lot less principal experience. So it's an interesting change and an interesting choice, especially in a time when a lot could happen. The volatility in the equity markets both Monday and Tuesday for me was very disconcerting because I'm a lot more comfortable with volatility in the precious metals markets because we're looking at something that's real, and the performance of precious metals this year and last year has demonstrated a lot more evidence that precious metals will perform like an alternative currency. So we see 2 days ago gold hit an all-time high in New Zealand currency. For 2008, it's up 95% in Icelandic currency. So it's really behaving like an alternative currency. The stock market is so much more dependent on government borrowing and government contracts and purchases to make earnings go. I took a look at an analysis by the King Report of price-earnings ratios in the equity markets in the big recessions since the Great Depression. And what the King Report pointed out was that the current trailing PE in the stock market is 22 times, whereas in severe recessions it's dropped on several occasions to 6 to 7 times. If we were to see that kind of drop, we'd see a Dow at 4,500. So again, I keep saying I'm a big chicken, and a big chicken means I think that this is a market which is extremely unstable. There's a lot of economic warfare going on, and the first 2 days of this week kind of underscored that again. 2 weeks ago, we talked about a blog post I put up called "The Fix Is In." We've gotten a lot of sort of yeah in the media, big article in Barron's, other articles implying that the dollar was just about to drop dramatically. In fact, the reason I called it "The Fix Was In" is it was just too much and it looked too orchestrated, and sure enough, the dollar has continued its miraculous performance of defying all economic fundamentals. One of the most important stories, somehow, you know, the number kind of gets buried on the blog, but it was at the top of the blog last week, but I want to highlight it for you. The Department of Labor announced that 2 weeks ago, all initial filings, so that's the first time they're filing, the total initial filings in state unemployment compensation programs were 952,000. So that's 1 million people filing for initial claims. That's a profound number. And it's a number that's hitting, again, when we're only, you know, we've got a long way to go just to write off the losses that we know about so far. The Memphis Papers reported this Sunday that the average national CD rate is 1.75%, and the average credit card interest rate is 13.42%. So what that describes is our relationship with the banking system on both sides of our balance sheet. So we're investing money in the banking system at 1.75%, and we're borrowing it back at 13.42%. So that's about an 11%, I would call it arbitrage or difference. Now, there's an opportunity there, which I'm going to keep coming back through to as I talk about the Godfather and the role of families. But if we're lending the banking system money at 1.75% and then paying 13.42% to borrow that money back, then not only can that never work, it's to, you know, all of our equity will be drained, but there's an opportunity to disintermediate the banks. I wanted to note in the stimulus package that the administration has put forward, they are capping credit card interest rates at 36%, which is an extraordinary number when you think that the Fed funds rate is 0 to 0.25%, which means banks can borrow from us through the governmental mechanism. It's the Fed, I know, but it's author, you know, we as citizens are giving them the power to create our currency. So as citizens, we're lending to the banks at 0%, and they have the right to charge us 36% to borrow the money back. So there's something wrong with this picture, and it's at the very heart of what's causing the unemployment numbers that we're looking at. The blog post that we put up last week, Defense the Real Stimulus Package, caught on and got just extraordinary hits, not just when we put it up, but continuing into this week. It's been republished widely around the Internet. That's a surprise to me because traditionally when I pointed out that there's $3.3 trillion missing from defense or that the people involved in that are somehow doing this or that, it generally has been considered a, you know, it's not a story that has sex appeal. I find it interesting that it's gone as strongly as it has, and I think part of it is as the bubble bursts, you know, when the bubble was going, nobody missed $3.3 trillion. Now when the bubble bursts, what people realize is we can't afford to keep throwing money down a black hole and think that there's any way out of the situation. So that's my wrap-up on money and markets. We're looking at a situation that is unstable and could get a lot more unstable, and the way out is to start to re-engineer the cash flows that are draining all of us, whether it's credit cards or the Defense Department. Okay, ask Catherine. First excellent question, what happens to our cash if global currency is implemented? Well, that's a big question because the critical issue is who's implementing the new currency? Who are they? What's their long-term goal? Where are they going with all of this? How is the currency structured? Some of the big questions will be, is it a fiat currency? So is it divorced from anything real? Or does it have a gold or other real standard backing? And in addition, is it paper or digital? If we get a currency that's only digital and a centralized authority or group has access to all the data, you know, it's a very different issue than if we have paper. Nicholas Negroponte, the former head of the MIT Media Lab, once said, in a digital economy, data about money is worth more than money. So a digital database that has all the transactions on all the money, and we can't transact around it means essentially that there is no privacy whatsoever, and it's a real invitation to create a two-class system: those who control the database and have access to it, and those who don't. Another serious issue, in addition to who controls and where they're going with it and what type, what the structure is going to be what is the exchange rate that our paper money or our dollars are swapped for the new currency. We've seen instances around the world where there's serious devaluation when or before that happens, other situations where it's relatively even, and so price is all, or almost all. So the question is, at what price? Next week we don't have a Solera report, but in the first week in February, we're going to be talking with Albert Bates about transition towns and financial permaculture, and we're going to look at the documentary, The Take, which Naomi Klein and her husband made about the economic collapse in Argentina. And it's a wonderful, one of the ways to think about what could happen if you're concerned about the dollar or real trouble in the economy is to look at other economy, where's that happened, and what happened to people, what did they do, you know, what worked, what didn't. So I would really encourage you to get the documentary, The Take. It's available if you're a member of Netflix. It's available from Netflix. Usually local, if it's not at your local video store, which it probably will not be, you know, that usually they're pretty good about ordering it, and it should be available. The other thing is I've invited for March a former government official from Estonia. Estonia was part of Russia and woke up one day and the ruble was worthless, so everybody's money was worthless, and they were transacting in things that they could no longer transact with. So one of the reasons I've invited him is to see if we can't get a personal description of what that was like, both from the point of view of a business person, a citizen, and a government official. Second question, the Baltic Dry Index steeply declined suddenly. What does it mean? The Baltic Dry Index, there's a great definition up on Wikipedia if you're interested in getting the full detailed definition. It's a number that is collected by survey in London and published by the Baltic Exchange in London. It provides an estimation of the price of moving major raw materials by sea. They track 26 shipping routes around the world, and it's really an estimate. It gives you an indication of global shipping. What happened between the middle of 2008 and December, so approximately a six-month period, is the Baltic Dry Index dropped, or is reported to have dropped, by 94%. Now, assuming, and I never assume that any of these numbers are correct, but assuming that this is correct, it's a huge drop. The various explanations given are we've got bankruptcies in shipping companies, we have a huge drop in commodity prices, which affects things. In addition, the financial problems that we're seeing in the banking system, part of freezing up global credit is that global letter of credits or sort of international letter of credits are getting hard, and that's causing shipping problems. I know here in Memphis it was reported that there was basically a boat filled with food from Latin America that couldn't, they weren't allowed to unload because of a letter of credit problem. So we're seeing an indication that international trade is dropping dramatically. Now, what does this mean to you? It could be a lot of things, but one of the things I really want to emphasize is we've been living in a consumer society where there's incredible choice and tons of excess goods. As the economy slows down, there are incredible sales, and so it's really a buyer's market. Now, if the Baltic Dry Index is and other indications of global trade are true, then we are looking at the potential within some period of time as those inventories get run off and companies go out of business to wake up in a world where that's all over. And in fact, there could be shortages, prices could be run up, and certain things you just can't get. The companies go out of businesses. So I keep I keep saying and I keep promoting, and I'm going to keep doing it, even though a lot of folks who live, who are used to living in a very abundant consumer society, can laugh at me. This is an excellent time for most people. Not some, there are exceptions, and everybody's situation is different, but for most people, to stockpile non-perishables. So what do I mean by non-perishables? Anything you use as you go through the day, whether it's printer cartridges or batteries or honey or olive oil or things that have a long shelf life or even an infinite shelf life, anything like that, if you buy it today and you have a 1 or 2 year inventory of whatever your needs are, then if we should get in a period where there are shortages or prices run up or we hit a hyperinflation, you are completely, or not completely protected, but you are protected because you have a 1 or 2 year inventory and you've got time to deal with the change without hitting real implosions in your basic day-to-day infrastructure. That's number one. But number two, if the yield you're getting on your CD is 1.75%, so on an after-tax basis is even less than that, then there is a very good probability that stockpiling non-perishables is a significantly better investment than putting the money in a money market or CD. So, and finally, if you look at the stories of anybody who's run into serious trouble, whether it was because they lived in Katrina, you know, in New Orleans during Katrina or whatever, the currency of the day in many situations is not dollars or precious metals. It's soap and light bulbs. And you know, if you read Dmitry Orlov's wonderful book on Russia, it's vodka. So it's a good investment, and it's a good risk management tool because then you don't have to worry. Anyway, so I'll beat that horse, I'm sure, again, but think in terms of what does the indication about global trade say to what you use, what you need, and how can you protect yourself if the consumer bubble bursts in a way that really runs up prices or creates shortages. Okay, third question. Which university should I attend? Is the Ivy League so tainted that it's not a good student choice? Well, this is something I could talk about for hours and hours, but let me take a little bit of time on this one because I think there's no more important issue economically than how we raise our children and help them get going in this world, because the way you build a great economy or a great civilization is one child at a time, and there are really no shortcuts. So if you know, human capital and our land and natural resources, so in combination what I call living equity, or some people call natural capital, is the source of all wealth. I mean, it's whether it's a human intelligence and effort or the effort and intelligence and resources of the land and animals, et cetera. So, so our education is very important. And I should just note, as a matter of disclosure, I did go to an Ivy League school. I transferred to the University of Pennsylvania and graduated college there, and then several years later attended their business school, Wharton Business School, and got my MBA there. What you need to understand about anything within our system is it's a little bit like a swimming pool. If you put red dye in the corner, it's not long until the dye is everywhere. And it's the same with money and money that has been earned in corrupt ways. It ends up everywhere. For example, after 9/11, the provision of defense contracts to universities exploded. And we've reached a point, whether Ivy League or state universities, essentially most universities are completely dependent on the Pentagon and the federal government to balance their budgets. So so in that sense, everybody and we all are tainted. And it's important to remember that. A university is four things in terms of, or a university from the point of view of a student is four things. One is it's an education. Two, it's a cultural and social experience. Three, it's a networking process, both at the school while you're there and then lifelong. And finally, it's a brand. Now, I will tell you from the networking standpoint and the brand standpoint, attending a good university is invaluable. So let me address brand. Wherever I go, whatever I do, no matter what's happening, the fact that I graduated from an Ivy League university and have an MBA from Wharton, which is one of the top business schools in the country, is always invaluable. I've been through periods of my life where I had a tremendous amount of money paying a lot of very powerful people or influencing a lot of very powerful people to try and destroy my credibility. And my educational brand was very, I was amazed because people give it much more credibility than I do, but I was amazed to see the extent to which, you know, it was supportive in supporting my credibility. So the brand is valuable, and the networking opportunities are phenomenal, and most good universities really make an effort to cultivate those networks over many, many years. If you look at the business model of many private universities, particularly the Ivy League, which are the masters of this, the real business model of the university is not a school, it's an investment network. The money is managed to really support and finance the syndicate. Rather than pay taxes, a percentage of the money is spent on quote-unquote good works, in this case education. And that amount of money is significantly less than the taxes the investment syndicate would have to pay if it was taxable. And in fact, the college or the university ends up providing enormous amounts of air cover to the investment syndicate, as well as providing a great number of people. And I think one of the issues when we help our children go off to school and we pay for the education is we're spending a great deal of money raising them and educating them, and then we ship them off someplace else. They never come back. And so communities are feeders to corporations. The communities get drained, and the kids end up going off and doing something that ultimately, or being part of something that ultimately is not what we intended. So let me address the cultural and social experience. Corruption in cultures varies at various universities. I took a sabbatical at MIT in 1995. MIT has phenomenal international diversity and talent. It's a very meritorious culture. It's really a culture of performance based on intelligence and hard work and accomplishment and problem solving. And it's really quite extraordinary because of the variety of the kids from all over the world who feed in. I used to go occasionally down across Cambridge into Harvard. It was a very hierarchical, much more social prestige conscious culture. The two were extraordinarily different. And as soon as I had about 10 minutes of Harvard, I'd go running back to MIT. So, you know, it really depends place to place. Okay, education. And I want to say this as positively as possible. The best educated people that I've ever known were self-educated, often didn't go to college, or if they did, they only went to college as an after the fact to get their degree. One of the best educated people I ever knew, her parents would move every 6 months so that they could keep the kids home and just completely homeschool them. Without any standards. I mean, they just did it completely outside of even the rules applying to homeschooling. When I started Hamilton Securities in the 90s in Washington, we put together a curriculum to teach people real estate and securities, and suddenly it helped me realize how quickly people could really master this information if they really wanted to. My pastor asked me to put together a curriculum for high school kids, and I did. It's up on the internet. You can access it through the archives. It's called Economics 101. And again, when I looked at that, I realized, given how much time we all spend in class, in K through 12, and college, there's no reason that every person in America couldn't be unbelievably literate in economics and finance. It's very hard. I mean, it's almost impossible in a university setting to get a clear understanding of the covert world, as we're going to talk in The Godfather. It's so important, particularly as the power of the covert grows in our world. So, saying all of this, if you go to an Ivy League university, you're going to have to slug through a huge amount of time spent on things which are either not true or intentional disinformation about the economy and business. And so if you're sticking in areas like architecture or engineering where, things are a lot more factual, it's one thing. If you're not, you find yourself in organizations which are really feeder systems for large business, large government, large banks, in a model that really teaches people how to go along with a system in which people are expendable. And so it's an awful lot of money to give a child an education which teaches them how to be employee but doesn't teach them all the different life skills they need to be successful, doesn't give them an accurate map of the world, and really doesn't teach them how to be an entrepreneur. Now, things vary, but if I was helping my child today, I would really trade off. I think about what they need in terms of brand and networking, and think about what they need in terms of education. And if I sent them to an Ivy League university, I would really want to make sure I'd supplemented their education. I wanted to give you just a brief example of a young man who's a perfect example of someone who should never go to an Ivy League university. His name is Kyle Tiernan. He's in his first year at Gaia University. Gaia University was created by Andy Langford and his partner, Leora Adler. It is a university where kids put together their own programs for a BA or a master's degree. It's accredited under the UK, and they put together their own program in a system where they can stay within their homes and communities and then come together with the other students in different places around the world for various projects and things. They have access to extraordinary teachers and advisors. It's quite amazing. Kyle had homeschooled with his mother, his parents. His parents are making a documentary called Thrive, which is very exciting. It should be out next year. And it really goes into how the world works in great detail and how we can build more positive futures. During that time, Kyle's senior year project and paper was on the banking system, and I was his sort of project advisor, and now I'm his project advisor at Gaia University. And he ended up, among other things, writing an article that was so fantastic. I published it in my column. Well, by the time Kyle graduated from high school, he knew more about how the economy and the world worked than probably 99.9% of, the American citizens. And so the thought of Kyle going to an Ivy League university is just frightening, because Kyle would immediately start walking around, correcting all of his professors, and it wouldn't work. In Gaia University, he's a championship surfer, and he instead is, right now I'm working with him on a project where he's connecting surfers and companies that sponsor surfers with an understanding of where they bank and what their banks are doing and how that connects to the environmental health and well-being of the ocean. It's a very exciting project, but the important thing is Kyle is learning in the process of taking action. His project is not something that just teaches him about how the banking system works or the environment works and how they connect together, but he's working on something that will change things and have a positive impact. So he's not just learning, he's doing. And that's a much more powerful model of learning. So should you go to an Ivy League university? It depends. I loved going to Wharton. I had a fantastic time at Wharton. I wouldn't trade it in for anything. It was two great, fantastic years. At the same time, you know, it can give you some things, it can't give you other things, and you need to be, it's like any, you know, it's like going into any store, you need to make sure you know what you're shopping and get what you want and know that, you know, that it doesn't necessarily have everything you need. And the last thing is, please don't take out a student loan to go to a big, fabulous university, because you need to make sure if you borrow money to get an education, that the education you're going to get is going to translate into the concrete financial benefits you need to pay off that loan. And many student loans are not, if you look at what you could do with that money to either get an education or build a company or trade that would generate an income, you know, you can do much better. Okay, so let's go to the movies. I have to tell you the story of how I came to discover the importance of The Godfather. Because I'd seen The Godfather, I'd seen Godfather 1 and Godfather 2 and thought it was, you know, a great movie, but hadn't thought anything of it. And then I was in the middle of the litigation that I went through in the 90s with the federal government, and things had gotten very serious and hard, and the courts were being very dirty, and the government was being very dirty, and things were just kind of, you know, the lawyers couldn't help you. You're kind of dealing in this Orwellian situation. And finally we got, after we put up a website with all the legal documents, a alternative press reporter wrote a story, and I don't know how he did it. He got Yahoo to pick it up as one of the hot picks of the day. Well, the story went electric, and within 24 hours I had gotten calls or emails from three very prominent people. One was the head of a top PR firm. One was a big real estate executive in New York. And they all had the same message, watch Godfather 3. Now, to this day, I assume they were referring to the fact that there were tremendous rumors always when I worked at HUD, whether as assistant secretary or as a contractor, that a lot of the programs and profits were at HUD, a lot of the profits of narcotics trafficking were being laundered through HUD properties or HUD programs. And that some of these networks related to various endowments, including the Vatican and the Catholic Church. Well, anytime I get any of these little messages, as I did often through the litigation, I always found they were useful. I didn't necessarily agree with the message, but I always found the information useful. And so I thought, okay, well, I guess I better watch Godfather 3. Now, I've watched Godfather 3, I would say, probably about 20 times. And that's an extra. I don't think I've watched a movie more often than Godfather 3. And every time I watch it, I learn more. So there's a lot in it, and there's a lot in it that relates to various stories. But let's walk through the three movies and just hit on the key themes. And again, if you haven't seen them and you're really interested, I encourage it, because you need to watch them with an eye of really understanding how our world works and think of it not as some separate organized crime family, but a little slice of the, you know, of the swimming pool with a red dye that we're trying to swim through. The first movie, The Godfather, was directed by Francis Ford Coppola, and it came out in 1972. It was based on Mary Puzo's book, which had the same name, The Godfather. And it's the story of an Italian mafia family, the Corleone family in New York. And it runs from 1945 to 55. And it describes the succession of the head of the family, called the Don, from Vito Corleone, played by Marlon Brando, to his youngest son, Michael, played by Al Pacino. And all the time this is happening, the family is grappling with what to do about narcotics trafficking. The family's in gambling and some other street businesses, but it's not in narcotics trafficking. And it describes the tensions and the risks that both the profitability and the violence of this business pose for the family, both the nuclear family and the wider criminal family, also called the family. And so this theme of how to deal with the prisoner's dilemma, that that the more profitable organized crime presents to the family, is an important theme. It's a theme that runs throughout our society, and you see it run through all three movies. The second theme, which is really important, is the hunger for legitimacy. Vito Corleone has built this business up out of the streets, and wants Michael to be legitimate. When it turns out Michael has to come into the family business, Michael spends all three movies trying to shift his business and his life into something legitimate. And you follow this theme throughout. The prisoner's dilemma of narcotics trafficking, there's one great quote where Tom Hagen, who's the played by Robert Duvall, who's the family attorney, the Corleone family attorney, argues that they ought to consider helping out and being involved in the narcotics trafficking. And I just want to read the quote because it's a beautiful example of the prisoner's dilemma that is faced by businesses and different organizations throughout our society right now. He says, "Well, I say yes. There's more money potential in narcotics than anything else we're looking at. Now, if we don't get into it, somebody else will. Maybe one of the five families, maybe all of them. And with the money they earn, they'll be able to buy more police and political power. Then they'll come after us. Right now we have the unions and we have the gambling, and those are the best things to have. But narcotics is a thing of the future. If we don't get a piece of that action, we risk everything we have. Not now, but 10 years from now." One of the things I really recommend, if you haven't read, is that you read Narco Dollars for Beginners, because it was an article where I attempted to explain to people who never wanted to know anything about organized crime and really, you know, didn't want to know a lot about high finance, to understand the relationship between narcotics trafficking and the economics of organized crime and respectable business and government, and why this prisoner's dilemma literally can only be solved by a broad-based cultural movement to insist that our money be clean. In other words, if the crowd will always vote for the guy who makes the most money, then we're going to live in a warfare and criminal society, because in many respects those businesses have higher profit margins. On legitimacy, there's a great scene towards the end when Don Corleone and Michael are talking, when Vito Corleone is talking, and he says, "I never wanted this for you. I worked my whole life. I don't apologize to take care of my family, and I refuse to be a fool, dancing on the string held by all those big shots. I don't apologize. That's my life. But I thought that when it was your time, that you would be the one to hold the string. Senator Corleone, Governor Corleone, well, it wasn't enough time. Michael, it wasn't enough time." And then Michael, who decides towards the end of the movie to ask his college sweetheart, Kay Adams, to marry him, he says to her, "My father is no different than any powerful man, any man with power like a president or senator." And Kay says, "Do you know how naive you sound, Michael? President and senators don't have men killed." And Michael says, "Oh, who's being naive, Kay?" And in fact, we see in these stories the seeds of destruction, because ultimately Michael and Kay's marriage and their family is destroyed because they have myths of what is and is not legitimate. So Kay thinks that there's this whole legitimate world and Michael's part of a dirty world. Michael thinks that he can rise high enough and find a place that's legitimate. And both of them have a perception of reality and create expectations for each other and themselves, which can't possibly be accomplished in the world in which they really live. At one point at the end of the movie, the Godfather says, "Women can afford to be careless, men cannot." And in fact, if there's any message as we go through Godfather 2 and Godfather 3 that these movies have, is that neither men and women can afford to be careless. And in fact, we can't afford for any anyone in the family to be naive or careless, because we're dealing in a world where the risks are great and the family is played against each other. One of the amazing things about the first Godfather and Godfather 2 and Godfather 3 is how silent they are on the role of all different parties or many of the different parties to these kinds of operations. So they're silent on the role of the intelligence agencies and the military in the introduction of narcotics trafficking into the U.S. because, in fact, the introduction was top-down. A decision was made to bring in narcotics to help accumulate the capital necessary to finance the growth of multinational corporations. You don't see that. It's presented as something that's being brought in by another part of the mafia. They also don't go into a lot of the information about how Las Vegas was really built and financed. So you see the mafia side of Las Vegas, but you don't see the Mormon Church or any of the other parties who were so instrumental in Las Vegas. Okay, Godfather 2 came out 2 years later as a sequel, and it tells the story of Michael Corleone in 1958 and 59 as he's building the gambling enterprises in Nevada. We get a real taste of how business and politics work. We start off with a scene early on in the movie where a senator tries to criminally extort money out of the Corleone gambling in exchange for helping to get a license, a gambling license. The situation is resolved because the senator, upon visiting a prostitute in the Corleone family enterprise, is entrapped in a situation where the prostitute ends up dead and drugs are involved, and so he has what is essentially what I call a control file. And from then on, the senator is a Corleone ally with at very little expense to the family because they have a control file. I'll never forget when I was Assistant Secretary of Housing, somebody kept trying to get me to do something that was illegal, and I wouldn't do it. And they kept saying, you know, we haven't found any dirt on you, but we have somebody going through the files, and we're going to get it. We're going to get the dirty pictures. And I kept saying, you're not going to get it. You're not going to get it. Their intimation was if they didn't get something, they just make something up. And in fact, I went through a process with my litigation with the federal government where I spent $6 million and 13 years of my life disproving something that somebody made up. And so in fact, I tell you this because oftentimes I have people tell me, you know, I want to go see my congressman about this. Why doesn't the senator do this? I want to, I expect this from government leaders. What we have to understand is that we live in a very violent world where people use blackmail and they use force. And when we think in terms of building constituencies for something, we need to understand that people in business and government, including ourselves, our family, our children, have these problems. And we need to be sensitive to them and understand how to protect each other from those ramifications. But one thing we need not do is spend tons of money and time trying to lobby a congressman who has a control file in a situation where whatever we do or say can't beat that control file. At one point, Hyman Roth, the Miami gangster in the movie, who's really you know, sort of a fictionalized version of the very famous Lansky, who was a big, very important to the financial operations and money laundering for the mob, tries to kill Michael when he's in his bedroom with his wife Kay. And what comes out in the movie is that Michael's older brother Fredo, who's jealous that he's been sort of skipped over in terms of succession in the business, has helped Roth, and Fredo, his brother, has betrayed him. By the end of the movie, Kay has left Michael, and Michael has arranged to have Fredo killed. and the family is torn apart. And it's one of many examples in Godfather 1 and Godfather 2 where siblings get played off against each other by powerful forces. In Godfather 1, Sonny speaks up in a meeting with one of the narcotics traffickers and thus triggers the assassination of his father. Connie, Michael, and Sonny's sister, allows herself to be played in a way that tricks Sonny, who gets assassinated. Fredo is jealous, so he allows others to use him to try and assassinate Michael physically and then politically later on in the after the first assassination. So we see families literally act against their own best self-interest and against the family interest because they don't see the game and they get played. You know, and so the message to all of us is how can we help each other see the game, and together how can we help each other not be careless? Godfather 3 was the movie that got the bad reviews and did not receive the awards of the other two. And the funny thing about it is, one of the criticisms is the plot is fairly convoluted. The reality is, the reason the plot is convoluted is because it does an incredible job of outing a whole bunch of, you know, or creating a whole bunch of fictionalized versions of real-life events, of the death of Pope John Paul I, of the Vatican banking scandal, of the global investment networks of the Vatican and the Catholic Church, of the use of real estate to launder money. You know, it's got a lot of those themes. It makes it much more complicated, but it also makes it an invaluable tool in helping you really learn about how money works from within a neighborhood and themes up into the corporate boardroom and into the highest levels of government and power. It's the movie premiered in 1990. In it, it's the story of Michael and his family 20 years later after the Godfather 2 breaks off. So it's 1979. Michael is trying to, he sold his interest in the casinos. He's trying to go totally legitimate. Again, we have Michael thinking if he just makes more money and go higher, he can finally get legitimacy. And he's buying a controlling position in the stock of Immobiliare, which is a European real estate conglomerate. And he's seeking ratification of his control by winning the Vatican votes. He's opposed by a group of Italian politicians and bankers in the Vatican Bank, and the struggle turns violent. And by the end, we see his daughter Mary assassinated, hit by a bullet that was intended for Michael, and the Pope is poisoned. It's made to look like a heart attack. Because he's too honest and he's cleaning house at the Vatican. You really get a sense of the role of endowments in this movie and the sort of dual role of an endowment, with one is sort of managing capital without taxes, the other being spinning off income that is used to do good works. And so you see this dual role, and it's invaluable to understand the world around you, and to understand when you look at the institutions that you donate money or give money to or you are involved in, sort of how those endowments are used. You see this myth that Michael had in his head of seeking legitimacy by going up completely exploded. There's a great scene where he leans back and he says, "The higher I go, the crookeder it becomes," as he starts to realize that crime is occurring in our world top-down, not bottom-up. At some point, the guys who are trying to stop the Immobiliare deal, the politicians at the top, use a street thug named Joey Zaza, who's probably a fictionalized version of the famous John Gotti in New York, really to stalk Michael. One of the movies we're going to do later on this year is Wild, which is another example of powerful interest using one guy to stalk someone that they want to bring down. And it very much parallels the situation I had in the litigation, because they had a little, you know, a, a small-time contractor kind of snitch go after me. And I spent years, listening to smears and not attacking because I didn't want to do it until I could see who was really pulling the strings. And it's interesting, the same thing happens in this movie. Michael is very patient while he waits to see who's pulling Joey Zaza's strings. What you see is the degrees of separation from the Pope to Joey Zaza in the street are very few, and the integration is instantaneous. And in fact, it's the same message as we saw in Syriana, because it says everything is corrupt, is connected. The corruption in Washington and in New York is not there. It's here, because you have 3,100 counties in America, and the narcotics trafficking, the mortgage fraud, all of it, all the economics work bottom up. So so if we're going to be successful as individuals or families, we need to see that game around us and appreciate that whatever we're watching out there, it's here, and it's here that we need to protect ourselves from it. This is really coming up because of the inauguration. This happens to me once every 4 years. I watch as the whole country kind of goes mad and puts their hopes on one person being put in charge of the machinery as if it can make an enormous difference. Now, given the damage done to the brand of the system, the system has incredible reason to want to reaffirm its legitimacy, but the idea that one person or a new administration can change the fundamental economics of the system in a profound way without tremendous action, particularly all of us voting with our money bottom up, it's not possible. And it indicates that we're still prey to the myths that we're watching in the Godfather. Now, one of the things, if you said to me, what is the one thing that could change, that could change everything else? What's the most important change we need to effect to change things? I would say it is that we need men and women to start to help each other share the same map of the world and to protect each other and protect the family. We need men and women to get to the point within our families and within our businesses and within our relationships where we really can trust each other and be trustworthy to each other. Because so much of the divide and conquer in our society depends on the double binding of each other that we see between spouses and men and women in other forms. I've written a couple of articles about this. There's a thread in Narco Dollars for Beginners, but there's also, I've written an article about what a woman can do to help the Popsicle Index go up. You can find it through the archives. I'll never forget reading an article by a senator who had made a ton of money on Wall Street in one of the dirtiest firms, that while he was there and while he was a partner making all this money, was involved in incredibly dirty stuff, including narcotics trafficking. And the article basically said that I, as a woman living in a southern town, I should not trust the men around me because they would not respect my rights. Instead, I needed to vote for him and his colleagues because they would protect my rights. Now, the absurdity of this article is here I'm surrounded by a group of men who have all sorts of different attitudes on women's rights or women's liberation or those kind of things. But if you really look at how they spend their time and money, they're investing a huge amount of time and money to protect me from the organized crime and narcotics trafficking and the other women in this community, whereas what they're protecting us from are the same networks that made, this particular individual wealthy. And so the absurdity of this, if you look at how the money works, this person playing divide and conquer, just to me is infuriating, but I can't tell you how many people fall for it. And so it's, you know, just one of many examples of how women and men have been divided and conquered. If you look at, if we're going to rebuild our economies, the first thing we need to do to build our financial capital is we need to build up our human capital. Right now, we raise our children, we educate them, we invest tremendous amounts of time and money in making sure they arrive at adulthood healthy and skilled to be functional in this society. And then if you look at most communities, what do? We ship them off to financial centers to work for big government, big banks, and big corporations. We ship them off to war. I live in the South. We ship a huge amount of kids off to war. Or we ship them off to prison. You know, because here in where I live, the amount of kids going off and being indicted for drug dealing or different illegal activities is extraordinary. So we're shipping off our most valuable investment, and the investment that can make the economy here strong, which is our young people. So, for example, one of the biggest financial problems in this economy is we have small businesses all over America, which have been built by the baby boomers, and the generation that the young people who should be coming up to buy it or to build it and be the heir and take it over is not there. They've gone. So we have literally financed and helped them go someplace else. So, for example, a little example is one of the greatest ways we export human capital is literally by allowing TVs into our home and giving all of our time and energy to watching them. And so we allow TVs into our home that teach our children how to disrespect their parents and disrespect the family. And adopt activities which are great for corporations because it teaches them how to be consumers. It doesn't teach them how to build financial equity or build skills in the way we need if we're going to have strong children and strong families. So in an ideal family, the family understands how to use their time and money in a way that gives energy and builds up the family. Now, in Godfather 3, there's one fantastic quote towards the end where the Italian politician looks at Vincent Corleone, the Michael's nephew who's being bred to run the business, and Vincent says, "I don't understand finance." And the Italian politician says, "Finance is a gun." When you watch Godfather 1, 2, and 3, what you start to realize is that Michael and Vito Corleone, who are viewed in their world as financiers, they're financing businesses and people, would no more finance someone, would no more put their money into something that they didn't understand, or no more put their money into something that was threatening to the family. They understand finance is a gun. And so as we go through our lives and we look at our money, one of the things we need to think about is whose hands are we putting our financial gun into? Because our own money has been turned into a gun that's being used against us. Now, I said earlier that the average credit card interest rate is 13%, and the average CD rate is 1.75%. Well, think of those two numbers in the context of the family, because throughout America, we have families that if you go back three generations, they've split between the cities and the country. They've split between different skill sets. They've split between different areas. But if you look at them all together, or even not our traditional families, but the families we've created for each other, what you'll see in those groups is you'll see some people who have capital and some people who don't have capital. And one of the opportunities before us is how can we start thinking strategically as families, again, whether it's traditional families or the families we've created. How many families are there where people have significant capital and other people are paying 13% to the banks? or just got employed, but are wonderful, hardworking, responsible people and could be helped to re-engineer in a different way. Up on the blog, there's a wonderful book. There's a review. If you do a search on the blog, there's a review of a book that John Hughes wrote about how families can keep wealth in the family. If you do a search for John Hughes and family, you'll pick it up. It's the title of it is Two Recommendations from Gift Hub. And it's a wonderful book about how wealthy families can stay wealthy. Believe it or not, I believe it's a wonderful book to help families who are not wealthy think about how they can act strategically together to be wealthy. And I would encourage you to watch, sit down one Saturday, get a lot of popcorn, and watch Godfather 1, 2, 3 right in a row. And then if you feel like it, read the book by John Hughes and start to think about where is the opportunity in your family to start conspiring to protect you and your family, because it's there that the human capital is being drained the most. And it's that drain we need to turn around if we're going to turn around the financial one. Okay, so we've come to the end of this Solari report. A couple of thoughts. On February 5th, we don't have a Solari report next week. On February 5th, we're going to take a deeper look at transition towns with Albert Bates, who's the founder of the Echo Village Training Center at the farm, a lawyer, a fantastic permaculturalist. We're also going to review the documentary, The Take. We'll touch on financial permaculture, which was the conference we had in Hohenwald last fall. We're going to have another one this next fall. The documentary from the financial permaculture conference has been finished. It's short. It's about 30 minutes, and we hope to have it up on the blog before the February 5th date. So you'll be getting a notice, and you may want to watch that as well. We've been posting the schedule both on the blog and the homepage, so take a look. We've got great people coming up in February and March, and you'll see more about that on the blog. So look for the schedule. You're in our prayers. Please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.